Welcome to the second ever New Scholars in Digital Humanities lecture. I would like to claim that it is the first such event of its kind in the history of the world. I do that boast every time I can. It isn't, unfortunately. DPhil students at Oxford give lectures close to the end of their degree. But when the idea of the lecture came to me, it was in ignorance of the practices in Oxford. So it can claim some sort of originality. It's extremely good that we have such a man to give this lecture. I'm going to ask Professor Andrew Prescott, the head of the department, to introduce him, and then it will be you listening to Øyvind. Andrew.
Thanks very much for the staying around. Thank you to everybody for turning up in such great numbers on a Friday evening for this very important occasion in the life of the Department of Digital Humanities, and I think in our wider intellectual life at King's. We have a lot of talk about what is the digital humanities, and I occasionally contribute to that discussion. But the answer is that digital humanities is the sum of the intellectual activity of those who are investigating that area. And the way in which that is driven forward is by creating new scholars and by young scholars undertaking new research. And the focus for that is the PhD. And that really is the way in which we can hope to develop the digital humanities as an area of intellectual activity. When one of my heroes, the historian Thomas Frederick Tout, went to Manchester and played a tremendous part in establishing the modern study of history, he did it chiefly through developing a big postgraduate program and developing a strong doctoral program. And I'm very pleased to see that we are going through a similar process here in the Department of Digital Humanities at King's, and that Willard in particular has played such a part in developing a very innovative cross-disciplinary doctoral program. So I'm grateful to Willard for taking it forward in such a way. What we ask doctoral students is to produce a piece of work which, when you're doing supervision sessions, you often suggest that they are like apprentice pieces, but I'm not sure that really is a very good analogy. It's certainly true that a doctoral thesis shows your ability to act as an independent researcher and on your own account to produce a professional standard of work. But actually the test that's in most regulations is evidence of an original contribution to human knowledge. And I think that's just the most astounding thing, both to ask of anybody and for anyone to achieve. An original contribution to human knowledge is quite something. And I think it's very sad that in Britain, what we tend to do is to rather shuffle that contribution to human knowledge quietly in. I suppose it's a rather British way of doing it. When I had my got my doctorate, I had a very discreet interview, very enjoyable chat with my examiners in a back room in the Institute of Historical Research, and a diploma arrived through the post some weeks later. That was the extent of it. But in Europe, I know, they have very elaborate defences of the thesis, and possibly that goes a bit too far, because it's a bit like academic debate as bullfighting. The poor doctoral candidate has his defenders and supporters and has to cope with anything that can be thrown at him or her from many different directions. But it does mean at least there is some sort of public celebration of the thesis. And I think this series, so generously supported and sponsored by the Arts and Humanities Research Institute here at King's, and I'm delighted that Professor Max Sanders, the director of the AHRI, is here to support us tonight. I think this idea of the New Scholars Lecture series is a very good happy medium between my rather discreet entry into scholarly life and the rather public occasions that we see in continental Europe. It's a way of celebrating the achievement of the new scholar and hearing newly minted contributions to human knowledge. So it's a wonderful occasion for us. So it's an enormous pleasure for me this evening to congratulate and welcome Øyvind Eide, who is the latest of our successful doctoral candidates from the Department of Digital Humanities. Øyvind originally studied in humanities computing at the University of Oslo and had a long-standing involvement in digitization and database development projects in humanities and cultural heritage. Since its very early days in 1995, he was working as a senior analyst at the Unit for Digital Documentation in the University of Oslo when they very kindly gave him 3 years' support in order to undertake his doctoral research with him. And Øyvind's thesis, the title of the thesis, was The Area Told as Story, an inquiry into the relation between verbal and map-based expressions of geographical information. And it's the most timely of theses, because the spatial term, as we describe it, seems to be flooding through the study of the humanities and being related to the digital humanities. And the need to develop a more sophisticated view of ideas of space and spatial representation is absolutely key. So it's a really important strategic piece of research that Øyvind has undertaken. And the external examiners who looked at Øyvind's thesis just before Christmas were united in their praise of an excellent piece of work. One of the external examiners was a very eminent anthropologist called Tim Ingold from the University of Aberdeen, who's written an extraordinary book, which I would recommend, on lines. Very interesting piece of cultural discussion. And Tim commented on Øyvind's thesis that it was a remarkable piece of work of great originality and calling for an unusual range of interdisciplinary skills. The historian, cartographer, media analyst and computer programmer, at the very least. And the author's practical experience of orienteering is also an essential part of the mix. It must be, I think, the first time orienteering appeared as something in the methodology of the thesis. But the praise for Øyvind's work isn't limited to his examiners. When I tweeted details of this presentation this evening, Alan Liu, who many of us will know, very eminent professor of English literature and pioneer of the digital humanities, was saying he'd heard Øyvind speak last week and described his research as eye-opening, which is praise indeed. So I'm really looking forward to the presentation this evening, and I'd ask you to warmly congratulate and welcome Øyvind Eide. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the very, very kind words and for inviting me here. It is it's very good, but also very sad to stand here to finalise my PhD project at the department. It's of course good because it's always good to finalise something, to be accepted, to hear nice words and constructive criticism. But it's sad because it has been a very good process. The whole PhD, from proposal for funding and enrollment through acceptance and the work with the supervisors, upgrade committee, VIVA committee, and all the rest, was an exemplary example of how academia should work, in my opinion. It was great fun, and the frustrations were mostly research ones, the ones you should not avoid anyway. So thanks to my supervisors, Professor Willard McCarthy, and of course the rest of the whole Department of Digital Humanities. There are many more names who should be named in this list of thanks, but some of them can be found in the thesis. So, what's the problem? The problem started with the question, why did they not use maps? There are so many cultures around the world and in history who didn't use maps. Why didn't they do it? Then it went through, what's the difference between text and maps? And when are maps better? To the idea of why not just compare them based on conceptual modeling. So the idea is to look into how things can be said in a text and how that might relate to how they can be said on a map, but also what can be said at all. Okay, texts and maps, what about the landscape? This talk is not going to be very much about the landscape because it's about media expressions of landscapes. But I will say just a few words because viewing a document representing a landscape is something very different from actually seeing a landscape, being in the landscape. One of the differences is that you use your eyes to look at documents mainly. But in the landscape, you move your whole eye, head, body system as you move through a landscape. It's something about the distinction, the fundamental distinction between document and practice. Maps are documents. Wayfinding is an activity done in a landscape. Maps can play a part in finding the way, but what Tim Ingle called the navigation is different from wayfinding without maps. And this distinction is muddled by expressions such as conceptual map, the idea that we have a map in our heads. I'm not going into the details here, but just make clear that my standing is that we are embodied creatures finding our way, and there are no conceptual maps. A very good work from the University of Chicago Press called The History of Cartography. It's claimed that there have more or less been no mapless societies. But the problem is there's a fundamental difference between artifacts we see today as maps when we find them in archives and museums and what the creators of these artifacts used, how they used them, what they saw them as. To take just the area of my study, map aspects did exist in the sense of inscribed objects referring to an external reality in ritual gems of the Sami and also in the layout of their turf huts. But they did not use maps to find their way through a landscape. Wood claims in 2010 that there were no maps before 1500. He also claims, it's not true. But the point is, there was an explosion in map production around 1500, a little bit earlier in China, but around 1500, in at least in Western Europe and Japan. And he connects it more to the development of the early modern state than to navigation. It can also, of course, be connected to production facilities and many other things. But it's quite clear that wayfinding have been done using words, body, brain, senses, landscapes, fellow creatures, and recently some maps. There are exceptions, but exceptions are just exceptions. The problem with the history of cartography is that they're not discussing maps, they're discussing things we think look like maps today, which is a totally different thing. So, back to the core of this speech. The hypothesis I set out to investigate is that types of geographical information exist that can be stored in and read from texts, but which are impossible to express on geographical maps without significant loss of meaning. And in order to examine this, I studied a text collection, manuscripts published in print and later digitized from the 1740s. It was written by a Danish-Norwegian military officer called Peter Schnittler, who took part in the process of establishing the knowledge they needed to establish the border between Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, Finland, that was established in 1751. And this was a time when they moved from overlapping tax areas to a fixed border between the states. One of the reasons why the tax areas were overlapping was that, especially in northern Scandinavia, the area was populated mainly by semi-nomadic Sami reindeer herders. So they basically moved back and forth. And the tradition of saying, the people paying taxes to us are... the farms of the people paying taxes to us is our... makes up our land, is tricky when people are moving back and forth. So the point is, they sent out this man to gather information. And in this situation, the common people, Norwegian, Sami, and also a few Finnish-speaking people, were seen as important sources to information based on their knowledge, not on their status. So what he did was to run court interviews with the people where he did formal interrogations taken down based on the legal regulations at the time. He wrote up aggregations to describe the larger areas to the best of his knowledge based on his sources. He also added a few external early documents to this collection. And he also made a few maps. And this material was the source for the study. The modeling I did was based on an idea of what I call stepwise formalization. I start out from the text, which I import into a computer application I wrote for this purpose. And I read the text and partly automatically and partly manually, I build up a set of statements about the text where I say, this string of letters refer to a place in the real world. This other string of letters refer to a place. This one refer to a person and so on. And then I made links to them, between them. This place is north of that place. This place is 8 miles from that place. Then I used that to build up a more formal sort of network-based model to present this material in a way that I could eventually use to establish vector data that could be presented as maps. So the point was to use several steps to go in a process where I took the information I read from the text and ended up by producing a map. And by following all these steps, I could see the information that fell off, the information I lost on each step. And the word modeling here does not only say that the whole process as such is a process of modeling, but we see that the map as such is not just a model of the previous step, but because it is a transitive process, the map is actually also a model of the text, because each step in the formalization process is a model of the previous. And the point in this process is, of course, to add and remove information. And what I'm trying to get at is what kinds, groups of information I have to add and have to remove in order to do the process. And an example on how this, this, in a way, runs through is the text has 8 miles as an expression. I first made kind of a formalized XML-like representation of that, where I say, based on the context, I assume this to be mountain miles, because, of course, they used several types of miles at the time, and it's 8 of them. Then I made another step where I said, well, for sake of argument, I say that a mile is 8 kilometers, so 8 miles is 64 kilometers. This, of course, could be different. I'm coming back to that. And in order to make a map, I then have to take the two places 64 kilometers distinct, and I have to give them coordinates. So if I put one of them in the center of the geographical thing, the map, then I have to put the other one 64,000 meters represented east of it, if east is the direction. And what's lost in this process is what I call fall-off. And these things are typically things like context, vagueness, underspecification, negation, and disjunction. And this research was focused on making an inventory of the things that fell off and tried to, in a way, group them together in a reasonable way. It is important here to make the point that I'm not putting information onto a pre-existing map, because that's a totally different process. I'll come back to that a little bit towards the end. What I'm doing is to say I have nothing. I don't have a map. I don't know anything about the area. I just, to the degree that's possible at all, I just base myself on my reading of the text without any previous knowledge. And this means that what I'm doing is I present the information as a map. I do not put it onto a pre-existing map. I will give you two examples on how I do this. This is an English translation of a short text from the material, Landscape West of the Settlers, with some forests and no neighboring farmers until 8 miles to the west, where Haran in a certain parish. A few lapfins dwell in between, however. These are some of the facts or factoids I extracted from this. It wasn't said explicitly in the text you saw, but based on the textual context around it, the speaker of this is a certain person. So he, in a way, is responsible for the statement as it was taken down. He swore to the truth of it. And then there are a place named Haran, and this is part of a parish. This parish is also, of course, referred to by place name. And there's also a place referred to by the phrase the settlers here, because it's, in this context, it's clearly pointing towards the place where they had their farms. And then we have a direction west from the settlers here to Haran, and a distance to Haran. Okay, and making a map of this is quite straightforward. Their farms to the right, their settled farms, and I put Haran as a point on the map because it doesn't contain anything else. Over Harans Prestiel, the parish, I put as an area because it's supposed to enclose something else, so it has to be. I mean, whether you put something on the map as a point or an area is not necessarily... it's usually based on some set of rules for the specific map we make. And you see the distance is 64,000 meters. The scale here is a meter. So that's all well and good. Problem is, there are no neighboring farmers, which was also claimed. There's no farmers between those two. And of course, it is possible to model it, but how do you put it on the map? The blank on the map obviously doesn't say there are no farmers, because a blank on the map says there's nothing of interest here, which is a different statement. It says nothing specifically about farms. So in order to express negation on maps, we must have an explicit completeness specification, in this example for farms. If the map clearly documented somewhere else in the context, in the text around the map image, that all the farms in this area are put on the map, then we would know a blank means no farm. Without that, we don't know. So this means that every point without the farm symbol is definitive, is defined as mapless, if we have that completeness definition. If we don't, we don't know. And for a map, it's impossible to make those kinds of definitions for a large number of different types of things. Whereas in a text, you can negate anything. The second example is slightly longer. It basically says that south of the settled farms they have, half a mile to the south, there is another farm, Kvaljen. And 1 mile, there's a third farm, Ledbakken. And the landscape in between is described a little bit. And there are two Kvan mountains under the farm Kvalien, between two other things. And then there are some details on how they live and the fact that they don't really have much food. And these are place names: Kvalien, Lerbakken, Frostvik, the lake, Kvar the lake, Kvar mountains, and so on. And then there are the reference to their settled farms and some directions and distances between places. And also between relationship. Something is between two other things. This is a map representation of that. From Deris Nybyggeplatser, half a mile down to this Kvalin area with three places in it, and Lerbakken 1 mile to the south. Okay, that's fine. Represents what the text says. But so do this map. So the point is that we have to make a set of choices in order to establish any map when we don't have any contextual information, any pre-knowledge. And the fact that this map looks reasonable and might just be accepted as the map, it doesn't really say that it's the only possible map. You can make any number of maps looking like this. The first map, we said that south was 180 degrees, straight south, and we made a default size of a place polygon when it doesn't say how big the place is, and some default distance and directions when something is said to be between other things. And also we define the length of a mile when the type of it is not defined. In the second map, we said that south is 160 degrees, slightly to the east, which is a reasonable interpretation of south, as it is used in language, and we also had some other different defaults. So the topology, based on these examples and many others I found through the modeling, is basically five classes. The first one is included as kind of measure point for the others. It's not found in the text. It's a fully specified textual description. It's hypothetical in the way that it would be a text where you cannot make only one and only one map based on the description. Then we have under specification, which means that we can have two different maps. We have ambiguity. I will come back to that. We have negation, as we saw. And we have impossible figures, and I'll come back to that as well. I use for an example of a fully specified textual description this snippet from something called geographical markup language. It's basically saying that this sets of coordinates make up a line. And geometrically speaking, it can only define one line. So that is fully specified. And the question is, why would one want to make such a fully specified description in natural language? When people use natural language, they tend to have context. For instance, when you make a text describing borders between farms, it's usually meant to be used in the context of the landscape. You walk the border, or in the context of a map. So it seems to be the case that it's very rare, at least, to have that kind of detailed specification of geometry in texts. If you need it, you write it into the landscape instead. This is the border between Norway and Sweden. And it's actually the border from 1751 that was marked up 10, 15 years after the border treaty was signed, and it has been maintained afterwards. Under specification is what we saw when we had the two different maps with 180 degree and 160 degree. I define it, as you see, as a verbal text describing a spatial phenomenon in a way that can be understood as two or more significantly different phenomena by a competent reader. So it's an ambiguity stemming from a lack of information. It's important to remember that such under-specification is always relative to the task at hand. In the situation I mentioned earlier, where you already have a pre-existing map and you want to put information on the map, things I find as under-specified here may not be under-specified at all, because you put this map into the context you use when you do your work. So the context of the reading is a necessary part of deciding whether something is under-specified or nothing. It's a relation between things based on the situation. And then we have 3 to 5, ambiguity and negation. This one is nice. It's an example who... It shows so many different things. Schnittler made interviews with people in 2 different parishes. And one of them said that the larger mountain within the blue circle was the border mountain, and the other one said that the smaller one was the border mountain. And he said the only way to reconcile and really know what's going on here is to put 2 groups of people together, which really show how focused he was on the knowledge coming from the people. But he said, as I'm not able to do that, he made a lengthy argument, and he argued that probably the largest mountain is the border mountain, because these are the people who probably would know better, and he made some other arguments about this. But when he made his list of border mountains in his aggregation, he put both mountains with an or between. Then in 1754 or 55, he made this map, 2 years later or something. And he put both mountains on the map, and both of them cross the borderline, the reddish line going down there. The point is not that he didn't put the or on the map, the point is that he couldn't put the or on the map. Well, he could write or on the map, obviously. But the spatial, the graphical language of the map can't convey that kind of disjunctive information. We have the negations we talked about. No peasant farms, no more Finns close to the border, and so on, where you need this completeness criteria. And there is something else that I was looking for, but I never really came to the bottom of it, so I'm not quite sure about it. It was the idea that if you put some pieces of information about places and their relationships together, you would, at a certain point, come to a point where the figure didn't make up in a way. You weren't able to reconcile how the geometry worked. I never found any cases where that happened, and I assume that is partly because of under-specification, because it's so little specification in this material, even if it looks very specified when you read it. So you never come into situations like that. But I also think it's connected, or maybe connected, to the fact that when you say it's a short walk to the pub, but a very long walk back from the pub, it doesn't necessarily represent a claim as the one on the screen, that the length to the pub is different to the length from the pub. I mean, based on the pragmatics of language, it means something else. But anyway, I still keep it in this list of things, but I'm not quite sure what to do with it. And this really brings us over to 2 different areas of research regarding syntax and syntactics. The reason why I'm talking about syntax and syntactics is that some people claim, and I agree, that it's not correct to talk about syntax for maps, because syntax is connected to some specificities with the directionality with language, put it that way. But they use the word syntactics instead. The point is, this is about relationships between signs. There are 2 lines of inquest here, and I will go into one of them. So I will first mention the one I will not follow tonight, and that is map semiotics. There are several works on this. In my opinion, the best one is written by McCashin and with the title How Maps Work. It's a kind of poetics for mapmakers. How do you make good maps? It's an interesting area of inquest, but I will follow another one. And that one comes out of the with picture of poesis tradition. And I will start tonight with Lessing's Laocoon from 1766. It is connected to what I said about the wording, the use of words like north, east, 8 miles, and so on. When we say that B is northeast of A, we say something with a certain amount of vagueness. And we can look at different maps with different relationships between places, and we will say all of them will fit this description. And we will use other criteria to decide which one is correct, if we're able to decide. On the other hand, once we have decided on a map, or once we have created a map, there's no ambiguity. If you have an object A and you have an object B in any kind of graphical figure, I mean, this is obvious, it's very well defined what kinds of angles you have between them. The direction is specified by the language, so to say, by the semiotics of the graphical presentation. I have extracted two rules from his work on poetry and painting. And one of them is the claim he makes that actions in time should be applied in poetry and bodies in space should be the object of paintings. Which means that bodies in space should be the object of maps. And the other one is his claim that you can't see what is hidden in painting, but things who are hidden can still be seen in poetry. One example is that when he describes a person in great pain, you can describe in his thinking about this, it's important to use mild, in a way, ways to express pain. So the play of muscles is a better way of showing pain than, for instance, a screaming mouth in a statue. And in order to show how the muscles twists in pain in a statue, it can't be dressed. However, if you want to describe muscles in poetry or in any kind of writing, you can do it perfectly well for a dressed person. Because the syntactics level works differently, basically. Another example on how this plays out is when you write a novel, you can be undecided about the skin color of the main character. That is very difficult for films. Of course, you can do it, but in a Hollywood film where you really want to show the actors, people will take things like skin color with them. I have tried to follow Lessing's study up through history, and in my opinion, Edelström in 2010 made a generalization of Lessing's claim, extension and generalization. Edelström wouldn't say that himself. But he generalized the comparison between painting and poetry to a kind of a classification of media expressions in general. And this is the system I used to try to understand the problems I've been discussing earlier on. It's a system working bottom up. It's based on analytical division into four modalities of a media expression: material, sensorial, spatiotemporal, and semiotic. And it works bottom-up. An expression will include all four of them, but each of them come in a form specific for that media expression. But they are still classifiable according to general rules. You can't divide anything, an expression, into modalities. This is distinctions and which are made for our analysis only. Each modality consists of various modes, and they are mixed in various ways, and I will go through the four of them. Edelstrom's definition of mode is, I quote, a way to be or to do things, unquote. In order to specify a medium, a type of mix between modalities representative for this specific medium has to be found. So in a way, you can see this as a way of defining media, although Edelstrom doesn't follow it to that end. And the first of these modalities is the material one. It's, according to Edelstrom, I quote, the latent corporal interface of the medium, where the senses meet the material impact, end quote. So it's not the physical substance of the medium, but rather the potential in need for something to be expressed. That which is capable of being manifested in the medium. And for written texts, they represent a demarcated materiality, which means that you can, in a way, put it in your hand, you have it physically before you. Whereas oral texts are less clearly demarcated. They are sound floating around in air. The map at this level is similar to the written text. The sensorial modality is the, I quote, physical and mental acts of perceiving the interface of the medium through the sense faculties, end quote. So a written text you meet by looking at it, an oral text you meet by hearing it, and a map you meet by, again, like the written text, by seeing it. Edelstrom makes a point here that once we're talking about recollection and understanding, sensorial stimulus is very closely related to this recollection understanding process. So all modes can be triggered by any medium. So even if you read a text, you can still trigger smell, for instance. I mean, the Madeleine cake of Proust is a case example of how this works. It is something I haven't really studied in detail, but it seems to be the case that written texts in general will trigger more feeling, more kind of taste and smell than maps. But this may be connected to how maps are seen as more objective, in a more objective way. But as I said, I haven't studied this in detail. The spatiotemporal modality, this is where it gets into the gory details of what we're working on. Edelstrom again, the structuring of the sensorial perception of the material interface into experiences and conceptions of space and time. End quote. There are four dimensions of our spatiotemporal perception. It's width, height, depth, and time. The three first define space. According to Edelstrom, and I think I agree in this, time works fundamentally different from space. They are seen as interconnected. So in this way, it's in line with Bakhtin's chronotope. But they are not as integrated as one may read Bakhtin to claim, at least. This lack of similarity between time and space is also something that is in line with Gibson, a psychologist, who wrote about how we experience the environment and is an important person for Tim Ingold in his view of the difference between wayfinding and navigation I mentioned earlier. It's quite clear that that's the next point. Space can be manifested in the material interface of a work. You can also have a cognitive space. I mean, a cognitive space is always present. You always have a kind of a spatial understanding. And you can create a virtual space, which is kind of recreated space based on the media you are, and the expression you are studying. It's in a way a parallel situation with time. It can be manifested in a material interface, but you will always have a perceptual time. You always experience a medium expression in time. And you can, of course, have virtual time, which is kind of a reconstructed time. Written texts have space manifested in a material interface. This is a tricky point, and it might be very close to the core of what I'm working on. Because when you look at the text, you look at the space. That's quite clear. But the moment you start reading it, and this is where language is difficult, you can say text turns into a line, but it's not necessarily fully correct to say it that way. But the point is, text is at a certain very basic level constructed as a sequence of characters and words. And then, of course, you have poetry, you have many different ways of reading, going back and forth and all that stuff. But still, there is a certain order to a text, which means that, in a way, it's not spatial, even if it is spatial. In a way, it's more like oral text, where you have time manifested in a material interface, where you don't look at the space when you hear a word, hear an oral text, obviously, because it's sound patterns in time. Of course, maps have space manifested in a material interface, and space, the space of a map and text are very easy to integrate. Maps have always been full of words, at least, place names. And this is, of course, because both of them, in a way, are spatial. Maps and oral text is still seen as two media working together as a kind of hybrid construction. Still, there is something Ellerström calls tension, and that is when a medium is not capable of expressing something but still tries to express it. This is related to how Lessing claimed that an art form should not go outside the natural, which is, of course, typically a new Enlightenment idea of things, the natural way of expressing itself. It's natural for bodies in space to be in a way where it's connected to a painting. It's natural for words or poetry to be time-based, to be used for describing events. Ellerström, of course, wouldn't agree, as virtually nobody would, with Lessing that you should stay within your boxes. But there is something happening when you try to push a medium into working differently from what Lessing called natural. And this is where this virtual space, virtual time, is created. And this is why it's important that the written text, although it's spatial, is not spatial in the same way as a map. Because the space you see on a map and understand from a map is different from the space you see and understand from a text. Because the space understood from a text goes in a certain way through this process of tension. It is recreated in a certain way. The last one is the semiotic modality. It's how the sign system works for the two, for various media. In Ellerström's words, the creation of meaning in the spatio-temporally conceived medium by way of different sorts of thinking and sign interpretation, end quote. His thinking is based on Peirce's semiotics with symbolic, iconic, and indexical signs. And as long as we discuss the basic sign systems of the media expressions, it's written and oral texts both are mainly made up by symbolic signs, whereas maps play on the whole area. Of course, the map image is indexical, but you also have icons on a map, and you have symbolic signs, like the cross for a church, which is also, of course, iconic, and the words on the map. The medium is not the message. Still, the medium influences the message. When Schnittler moved from an interview to an aggregation, where he thought back to the interviews or looked at the written interviews he had and wrote aggregations, he could remove any kind of difference, make any kind of changes he wanted to. However, when he made maps, again, either based on his knowledge or based on the texts, there is some media pressure forcing him to do things differently on the map from what he was able to do in the text. So making a text based on a different text is fundamentally different from making a map based on a text. So this is, in a way, starting to sum this up. The descriptive aspects of Lessing's model from 1766 is generalized in Elvstrom's every medium has the capacity of mediating only certain aspects of the total reality. Which aspects are based on the specific form of the modalities of each work, and they can be classified. Maps do include texts, place names, and so on. And the internal workings of a place name plays by the rules of a text. No one would say, or people have said, but mostly as a joke, that the O in London is east of the L. It doesn't work that way. But the moment you take London as an expression, then it plays by the semiotic, spatial rules of the map. Then London can be said to be northeast of Bournemouth, or it can be said to be north of Bournemouth. It can even be said to be south of Bournemouth if the map is wrong. Maps do not usually include narratives. However, by adding narrative, by adding text to maps, you create a hybrid construction. So it's not about adding text as such, it's about adding specific kinds of texts. It's not about adding the words of a place name or some other descriptive statements like hic sunt leonis or whatever. It's about the moment where you start telling stories with the map, where you start making lines and inferences and in a way putting time into the map. Then you start building up this hybrid document. And you get geocommunication. Geocommunication is, of course, very hot today. Google Maps showing you the way by using a geocommunication combined way of expressing images, maps, texts, oral or spoken, or oral or written, and you have it in GPS systems and so on. But of course, this is very old. Whenever somebody picks up a map and starts telling a story to somebody else using the map, then you have a situation of geocommunication using the oral text and the map. It's important to push the barriers of maps and texts. It's important to try out new things. Try to do all this sort of nice mappings people are doing today. But it's also important to remember that map or text lacks the expressive power of map in addition to text. Combining them in geocommunication gives more than any of the media can give alone. So, what about the future? Seen those before? These points are fine. That's why I put them there. But they would work basically for most, if not all, research projects in want of more funding. So, the question is, what do they mean to me? When I say more evidence, I want to study more different texts in different genres. I would be very, very happy if other people would do it with similar or different methods as well. How does it work for a new wave science fiction, modernistic poetry, the drama, but also different scripts? different writing systems, totally different types of documents. How would this work for pre-Columbian Aztec documents, as far as we know anything about them at all? How would this work for hieroglyphs, different types of hieroglyphs? How would this work for Chinese texts? I haven't studied it. Would be great. Better methods. One of the things is to improve and make more advanced modeling. The modeling I did was rather simplistic, especially in the geometric area of geometry. I'm not that vexed in mathematics. When you have somewhere and you have somewhere else east of it, as I said, you don't really know what east means, so you have a sector. You don't really know how what 1 or 8 miles means, so you have this area in which B can be located. Okay. Then if you go on from B to another place C, claim to be somewhere relative to B, then you will have the C1, C2, C3, C4 area, because from any point in B, you have to make this same fan for where C could be. The fun part is that if you go on doing this, you might at some point come back to A, which means that you can start adding information to the model by removing the uncertainty of the model. So you can shrink the area of some of these polygons by adding more information. This has been shown for time, and it may work for geometry, for space, but I'm not quite sure because it's a bit complex. More experiments. What more can be done with digital mapping? It is clearly the case that what I'm saying about what maps can do is mostly based on how we read maps, not only how maps, or you can't say how maps work without people reading them, and they have to be used to be meaningful. So, can user expectations change? Is the main question here. Because it is quite clear that people would accept fuzzy objects on maps. They see them every day. But that is for thematic mapping. If you're mapping the area where a certain animal have their habitat, then the area can be fuzzy. But fuzziness is generally not used for topographical aspects of the map. You don't use fuzziness to mark up a town, usually. But this may or may not change in the future. And of course, more speculation. It would be great to further develop the Elvstrom-based model of the differences between maps and text. Certain amounts of what I have been saying is quite obvious. How far can we get beyond the obvious here? And also, what is the role of the place name as a connector between maps and texts? They are used in maps and texts, they are used in a similar way, but they relate to their contexts quite differently. So it's much more to say, but I end. Thank you.
Time for questions. After questions, there will be drinks and nibbles in the room next door. And between those two, Professor Saunders will have an announcement. So that's the rest of the evening. But now, questions.
I'd like to make an observation prompted by what was said and then use it to fuel a question. When Schnittler is talking to his interviewees, what he's getting from them is a distillation of their experience, okay? So that they can describe where things are because they have walked through a landscape, which is a real-time process. And it struck me as you were talking that when we read a text, and particularly when we listen to an oral text, have to do it in real we're constantly shifting and adjusting our perceptions because, as if you were, for example, listening either to this sentence or, say, to a sentence by Henry James, where you think you are at the beginning of that process is probably not where you will realize you are at the end of the process. So you're constantly shifting and adjusting because of the syntax of language. And if you're walking through a landscape, you're constantly adjusting your idea of the landscape as things change. So if you crest over a rise of a mountain and you suddenly realize that the layout is quite different from what you thought it was going to be. And through multiple repetitions of those processes, you can arrive at either, you can distill that experience into, I can now draw the landscape that I know because I've moved through it, or I can write about or speak about that landscape in a distilled and finished way, give a kind of overview. So there's a real similarity there between landscape and the resulting map, either a drawn map, a graphic map, or a verbal map, which is what these interviewees were doing to Schnitt, as verbal maps as they constructed. And I wonder if you've given thought to how important the activity of the Sami was in constructing what they eventually said in their verbal representations of the landscape. You know, what lies behind it, all those journeys they made, and the kinds of, where were they walking? Did they always follow rivers? Did they always avoid mountains? What effect did that have eventually on what they said to him?
I mean, it's quite clear that the way they traveled and also the way they would look at the landscape would be based on the practical life and skills as well as on their cultural beliefs, broadly speaking, including religion and everything that helped you build up a worldview. And which means that what they were giving to Schnitler was not the landscape, but their, as you say, their understanding of the landscape built up through even a few years, if they were young, or many, many years of using it. And it is also quite logical, although I haven't studied it, that people with different relationships to landscape would give different stories. However, they found themselves in a situation of communication, and not necessarily, although that is hard to know, a very unfriendly one. So, of course they were playing games. Everybody was playing games in order to gain the best out of this situation based on the knowledge they had. But they also, as I understand the situation, were trying in a way to help him. Somebody's asking for help, you're providing something to help him. And so it was also to a large extent based on what they thought Schnitler would want to hear. Of course, it could be in an opportunistic way, I want to tell him a story he likes, but when you look at how the interviews works, that doesn't seem to be the case, but because sometimes it's really pressing people. Are you really saying that? But other people said, do you really believe? So at least many of the witnesses really stood up and said, well, this is what I mean, this is what I know. But they tried in a way to be informative, which means that the knowledge they started from was, of course, based on the way they perceived landscape. But the story they told was, in a way, an example of intercultural communication where they tried to understand his urge for knowledge. And to say a few words about him, he had been a military officer for many years. He had been he had a legal position in the army before that, so he was trained in running interrogations and legal processes. And he knew the area quite well, and he knew people quite well because he had been a commanding officer for 15, 20 years with recruits from basically many of the same kinds of people. So they have this possibility to communicate, and they tried to communicate. But it's quite clear that a modern traveler, even if this modern person didn't use maps either, would give a different story. For instance, a modern traveler would, in general, have good reason to go to mountaintops. Whereas a traveler in the 18th century would, in general, avoid mountaintops because they tended to be very high and very cold and, I mean, useless. You might have to go up to high places somewhere to look for deer and stuff like that. But in general, you traveled in a different way because your aims, you're traveling for different reasons. I don't really know if this was an answer, but...
So.
Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much for that. That was really, really interesting. I've got a question about literary tourism. Julian Wolfe has just published a book about Dickens in London, where he says that if you... Well, contentiously, I think, if you go back and look at old maps and try and recover Dickens in London, that can't be done because you're not capturing the perceptions that are wrapped up in the text, and Dickens in London was never real, it's all perceived. So I was just wondering, from that, have you thought about the possible implications of your work for literary tourism and that kind of literary criticism?
I would say it thus. If you map a text, which is what you're often doing, I haven't looked much into tourism, but in literary criticism you make maps based on texts. You, in a certain way, add information. And in a certain way, you then reduce the freedom of the reader by adding information. It's kind of a logical conclusion, at least to start from. So this means that you make another version of the text. That version, seen alone, the map alone, is of course much, much poorer than the text. And the text is richer than that. But it's also a case that the combination between a text and a map is richer than any one of them. And this means that you are, in a way, you are making an interpretation of the text. And making interpretations of texts are perfectly fine as long as they're not presented as truth. Which means that when you make products of literary tourism or works of literary tourism, I would assume it's important to be clear about your attempt to make an interpretation to enrich the experience of the work, not to make an interpretation to fix the experience of the work. That was more of an answer.
Anyways, I was intrigued by your discussion of medieval maps and your suggestion, as an interesting idea, that to some extent what we're looking for are things that look like maps rather than maps themselves. But I also wondered whether actually your discussion had made us understand the nature of some of the medieval maps much better. An example I was thinking of particularly is that there's a map produced by Gerard of Wales in the 12th century, that's a map of Europe, that to some extent seems to, certainly in terms of the roots, seems to reflect his own experience as somebody travelling from Britain to Rome. And the maps he's marking out, the routes he's marking out, aren't measured, but it's suggesting a sense of his feeling as somebody moving through the landscape. And I wonder whether you thought that was a valid approach to medieval maps, to see them as something that was perhaps closer to an attempt to capture that experience of the wayfinder.
I actually haven't thought of that. What I have thought for medieval maps is, without any detailed knowledge of them at all, I
find them similar to the Samaritan drum in the way that although they may have references in the real world, the Sami drum to a certain degree, the Mapamundi much, much larger degree, still that's not in a way the point. One can claim that the point is more as a kind of presenting a world of which the physical world is just part. So the world presented by such a graphical device is something bigger, fuller. It's the religious space, of course. And it makes sense in a way if that is how you think of maps. When you make a map of a travel, you map your experience as much as you map landscape, because maps don't have this strong connection to physical landscapes that we tend to give them. This is, of course, also based on mapping techniques. But of course, there are examples of maps before medieval times with a stronger connection to a physical reality than you see in most medieval maps. Of course, with exceptions, some of the seafaring charts and so on, but at least if you look at Mapamundi. And so, without knowing these kinds of medieval maps, it sounds like it's making sense in a way.
I really enjoyed it. It occurred to me quite late, just why this is a very useful way of thinking about recreating spatial relations and historical texts. I'll start with starting on end with a question. One of the things that we have been, in this case being myself, has struggled with is to create maps out of very high resolution spatial information we have from, in this case also, medieval Chinese texts. There is such a high level of resolution, mostly related to water as well as mountain locations, that we cannot only not find it in an existing historical GIS set or current GIS set, we cannot even find it on Russian or Japanese maps, which obviously have the highest detail. So what you're suggesting is that what we probably should be doing is to map the spatial relations that we have for the architectural descriptions of this, and I think that might be what we should do with that. The question that comes out of this is whether you've thought about what the implications of what you're doing are within sort of broad field of historical GIS and approaches to mapping in the historical sense.
I think one thing coming out of it is a possible technique. I would say that taking a large text collection and extracting information in this way and making an open, as I showed towards the end, with polygons representing places where they possibly can be, and making these kind of complex geometrical systems is very far from being applicable to practical problem solving. But if you have 95% of the places identified in modern or contemporary maps, depending on the period you're working on, and have a few places you're not able to find, then these kinds of open modeling methods can be used. I mean, you have seen it, for instance, in texts describing expeditions, where you suddenly come to a place where they spent a night somewhere and you realize that because they didn't know the local language, they took down a word meaning oasis instead of a place name. So you don't really know where it is. But if you have the last night and the next night and you have the possible travel speed and you have a contemporary map, you can usually at least find some candidates. So this has been studied before. As for the more theoretical implications, I would say that, as at least not a trained historian in any formal way, I would say historians know this already, that if you extract geometrical information from a medieval or even early modern text, even contemporary texts, it's always fuzzy, insecure. You don't know what you're doing fully. You always have to take all these precautions in the work. But so in a way, I see it more in that context as an example of something known than really giving you new knowledge.
Thanks. I want to ask about the other process that seems to me to be implied by the one you're talking about. I mean, you're looking at what happens when you go from text to maps, but how reversible are that and the opposite of going from maps to texts? And I wonder when, towards the end, you were talking about the process of reading and interpreting maps, and that seemed to suggest that whole possibility of running it the other way. And I suppose the some more precise question would be, do you think when you go through that process of looking at maps and trying to understand them, to what extent is one trying to convert it back into text or convert it into text in some way?
I mean, one thing, of course, is that we have Ptolemy, in a way. Ptolemy's attempt to write out his map as a text. And I would say that would be more or less a process of what in other areas would be called linearization. So you can basically, and when you look at modern maps and how they are very often produced by vector data, in a way they are always already linearized, because making a map is to take a linear vector data expression and making a graphical image based on it. And then of course you could take it back. Doing that for map images or paper maps is doable in different ways. You can take each pixel, like in kind of a raster scanning, or you can detect all the features. And I mean, this has been a commercial process for many years. What you're missing by doing this is that looking at a map is a peculiar combination of overview and detail. This is one of the reasons why paper-based maps still give a sort of overview detail combination, which is very difficult to find in digital maps. Because to move from overview to detail in a digital map, you have to do an active process, and you have to change the map by zooming it. Whereas if I take a 5-square-meter map here, I have the overview, and I can zoom into details by just refocusing. So it's a different process. And you lose that if you linearize it. So I think moving from map to text, it's not as much that you are not able to capture everything on the map. In many ways, I would say you most likely would be. The problem is more that you are not able to capture the functionality of the map. So using a textual version of the map is impossible in the same way as using a map. But I haven't really ventured into that area except for doing a little speculation. So I haven't tried it.
Why do you think there has been this fever for calling nearly everything a map? To the point at which the word ceases to mean very much. I know you've thought about this, but I'm wondering, the broader historical question is, what's going on when something like map, or a word I'm preoccupied with, memory, becomes enormously popular, and it seems to apply to everything, and everyone jumps in and starts talking about it?
I think what happens is that you take a physical thing that we use for a purpose, like a map, and we use it in this line of thinking. We use it for the purpose of finding the way. Then we say everything we use for the purpose of finding the way is a map. So we basically go from document to function. I think it might be similar to a certain period, which may or may not be over, where everything was a text. Because everything can be read and understood as a text. Similar but not identical, because that was also, I assume, connected to a certain imperialism of lines of study with which I also been attached 3 years ago. And for maps, I don't really think it's imperialism, because this is common language use. It's not evil cartographers trying to spread the empire on the map. It's really people who want to believe this, and they want to use the word map this way. And I think that in a descriptive lexicographical work, obviously you have to document this as an actual use of the word map. It can be used for conceptual map. It can be used for textual map. It can be used for anything that assists you finding the way. But in a scholarly discussion, it's important to have words for the things we're talking about. And I found it convenient to have a short word for the thing we see in documents with certain kinds of references to the word. So in the dissertation, even a topological map is not defined as a map for me, because I want to use this word for a specific purpose. And it's so close to the basic and historical and etymological meaning, well, not far back, but reasonably far back in etymology, to make this, I would say, defendable. But it's a problem I tried to solve by using the word geocommunication, because geocommunication is the word I use for what other people call maps. So when they call a GPS system a map, when they call an oral description map, then I would call a geocommunication system. I mean, map goes beyond that, because you have mental maps and all that kind of stuff, but still.
Adam.
I'd like to ask about feelings. I've always really loved that maps are beautiful creations of art. And if you think of the front page of a fantasy, the first page of a fantasy novel, you open it up and there's the map of whatever the world is, and over here's the jagged mountains and the dragons over there. And you're given information about how to feel about the place from the map. And I noticed from your maps, they're basically devoid of that type of emotive feeling. So I was wondering, is that a conscious decision you made to not include that layer of information, and why?
Well, the short answer is because this is a father murder on maps. Because I was a map reader from the time I was a text reader. So I've been using maps for the time of my life minus 5 years. So I've always been using maps. I always loved maps. I think I actually read Tolkien because of geography and not really for... Well, eventually I moved more into the Lord of the Rings faction. But the maps, the geography, historical atlases, all these fantastic worlds you don't know anything about. I would say that the map in itself is an untold story, which is fascinating, even ugly maps like the ones I make. I wasn't specifically trying to devoid the maps of this kind of feeling, but it was a natural consequence of attempting just to make maps based on the very specific items that came out of my model. So technically speaking, what I did was to build up an RDF triplet model where I had short sentences, basically, and relations between places. And then I used those relationships to say, well, if this place is here, for instance, in the center, then this place has to be here because of the relationship, or somewhere here, based on the choices I make. And that's the only information. So I fed that into the vector data, and then I just presented the simplest map I could based on that. So, however, it might be that there is a kind of a subconscious reason why I didn't make maps who look like maps. It's something about these models are really... It's not a very nice way to use maps, basically. So, maybe I tried to protect the maps from my sacrilege or something like that.
last question, which just occurred to me. As you know, I'm really fond of things that fall off. Sometimes I think I'm running after the academic wagon and picking up the things on the ground that fall off, finding them the most interesting. You describe the process, the formalizing process of the things that fall off. If that, in broad terms, there is an historical process from a time when there were very few maps or people didn't commonly use maps, to a time when people mostly used maps rather than descriptions of how to get someplace. There's a lot of things that fall off when you get a map, and there are all sorts of things that you gain. And this seems to me to be a paradigmatic case of a transition from one kind of, to speak very broadly, one kind of technology to another, in which you gain some stuff and you lose some stuff. Is that a plausible account?
If you say from 100 or 10,000 technologies to one technology, then it might be. Because the way people found their way through a landscape was so different. Mm-hmm. When the first president of the Sami parliament, he was also an orienteer, and he went to high school in southern Norway as part of his, in many ways, fascinating biography. He became a professor, but he went through the first years in school without understanding the language taught. So first in fifth grade, he suddenly realized what Norwegian was, because he didn't know the language, and that was the only language they were allowed to use at school. Anyway, he became a professor eventually. And he, when he did orienteering, map-based, where he grew up in Finnmark, where it's kind of a mountainous, rather flat area without vegetation, basically, not much. He would look at the map, he would know where he was going, and he would run there. Whereas when he came to southern Norway, with lots of vegetation, lots of hills up and down, and all that stuff, he had to readjust his way of using a map. He actually had to use a map in a totally different way. He had to read it and follow it. And he had to take care of the scale, which he hadn't previously. So this was his specific process change. If you come from a culture practicing dead reckoning, where you walk around in the wilderness for hours and then know exactly the way back, I don't believe this, but people claim that it's true, so I just have to accept that they claim it's true. Then, of course, moving into using maps is a totally different process. And mainly that process, I would guess, would just say you don't do the 10, 15, 20 years of training into an understanding where you can do that record. You just use a map instead. It's also the case that this change is necessary because people travel in a different way from what they did. If you travel no longer than 5 miles for your whole life, of course you don't need a map. You know the area. When you're 12, you know the area you will travel for the rest of your life. If you're semi-nomadic, you will travel back and forth. I mean, there are diverses. You're moving off and on, but still, it's the same general area. And if you go out becoming a wolf hunter or something, so you really travel around, well, you have the equipment you need. It's impossible to get lost, because you have yourself. The only way to get lost is to lose yourself. Being not knowing where you are is not a concept with any kind of meaning at all. And if you want to re-find your family, well, if you continue traveling, you will sooner or later meet some people. And they will, in a way, put you into the order of things, which is all spatial, religious, family-based, and so on. You will know the relations to these people. You will know who are their parents and their relatives, and you will make a pattern. And that will give you a way to re-find your family. It's not about being lost and re-found. So of course, all these things will not necessarily be lost, but will be very different. Because using a map is so cheap. I mean, it's so easy to use a map. You can go anywhere, and with a map you can very, very rapidly, even if it's a totally different landscape, and a map type you don't know, is very, very easy for the majority of us who can actually read maps, to cope with this. Whereas what I've tried to do the last 15 20 years, trying to find your way without the map is so much more difficult. Because then you have to relax and you have to use subconsciousness in order to really find your way without maps. And that is very, at least for me, much, much more difficult than actually reading a map. So, yes, you're losing something, and I think you're losing things who used to be important because they were needed. They're not needed anymore, so they're not important in that way. In the ways of most people here, of course, they are still important because we think things are important because they have beauty or whatever, but things you don't need anymore tend to just go away.
Thank you. I had no idea it was such an interesting question. Thank you.